Hi there, and welcome to this episode of A Couple Takes on MS. Hi, I'm Dan Digman.
And hi, it's me, Jennifer Digman.
And we're A Couple Takes on MS. I'm walking.
I'm rolling.
But together, we're moving forward. Today, we are honored to welcome to our episode Professor Rob Model, a leading researcher whose work has transformed how we understand the role of exercise and physical activity in managing multiple sclerosis. Rob holds faculty appointments in the departments of kinesiology and nutrition and rehabilitation sciences at the University of Illinois Chicago. His research focuses on how movement, fitness, and behavior change can improve mobility, cognition, fatigue, and overall quality of life for people living with MS. Rob has published hundreds of studies and is recognized worldwide as a key voice in the neuroscience and exercise of MS. We're excited to talk with him about what his research means for everyday life with MS and how staying active can make a difference. Well, Rob, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here with you, Dan and Jennifer.
This is fantastic, and we're excited to talk with you. And I guess the first question straight out of the gate is, what got you interested in this type of research?
Jennifer, that is a great question. And sometimes I even have to ask myself that question. really, you know, the answer is a little bit of luck. Some great mentors and some funding from the National MS Society. So I had done my dissertation research at the University of Georgia, and my mentor had me do six different research studies that were examining the effects of single bouts of exercise on spinal reflex pathways in the general population. And all six of these studies ended up being failing studies. And why they failed is because they all showed that exercise changed the spinal reflex, but not for the reason that we wanted it to change. So I presented these six failed trials when I was interviewing for jobs. And in spite of my failures, I was able to get a job. And one of my mentors would ask me every single day, Rob, have you figured out the clinical relevance of the exercise effects on the spinal pathway? And it just kind of drove me a little batty hearing that on a regular basis. And one day I was in the library and I picked up a journal called Brain, and I was reading this article on the application of baclofen for reducing spasticity in people with MS. And they were studying spasticity using the exact same experimental preparation and spinal reflexes I was using. Wow. So I went, wow, this is exercise and spasticity, and this is a paper on MS. I wrote a grant to the National MS Society. They funded it, and the rest was history. It just took off. And all the impact I've seen in people's lives over the past, you know, 25 years really has been the glue that has held this all together.
Yeah, well, fortunate for us, those of us in the MS population, that this glue has stuck and that we're understanding more about the importance of exercise in treatment or managing multiple sclerosis.
Well, I think that's the big question. You know, Jennifer and I have each lived with MS for over 25 years. And so it's like when we were first diagnosed, that was something exercise was something that was semi sort of discouraged, just in the sense they didn't know what that would do for you physically and stuff. What do you know, like, what was the flip? I mean, what convinced them that the exercise is really pivotal and needed in living with multiple sclerosis?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting that you asked that question, because I've really traced back the root of exercise in the history of MS by reading Jock Murray's book on the history of a disease. And, you know, exercise was being used to manage disease outcomes in MS way back in the early 1800s. Then somewhere in the early 1900s, there was some research on Uthoff syndrome, which was the idea that when people with MS were heated up, there was an increase in their core temperature, mm-hmm. they would have some temporary blindness or vision distortion. And they extrapolated that into, you know, exercise can heat people up and result in this temporary visual worsening. And, you know, I wouldn't necessarily dispute that exercise heats people with MS up, because if you exercise, it heats anybody up a little bit. But what we don't see is this broad scale visual and other kind of sensory abnormalities. And the real big break in this, Dan and Jennifer, came in the early 1990s, when Jack Petejan and Ed Gatmeier at the University of Utah were funded to do the first randomized controlled trial of exercise training in people with MS. And they did just a really, really well-designed first randomized controlled trial. They used a really strong exercise training stimulus. They had a really good control condition. And they were able to show that this 15 weeks of high-intensity aerobic exercise didn't make people with MS worse, but it actually helped to make all of their symptoms, their health profile, better. And that really opened the doors to this field, because it was done by a neurologist, it was funded by the National MS Society, and it changed people's perceptions of exercise as something that was harmful to actually something where exercise was beneficial for people with MS. And it really, it just opened up a lot. Now, it took about 10 more years before the field really caught on, but, you know, that was the real beginning point of the surge in research.
Oh, wow. And so, as Dan mentioned, he and I have both been living with the disease for over 25 years, and I don't ever think you get comfortable with the disease, but we're managing it in a more where we're used to the disease. But Rob, if someone was newly diagnosed and they stumbled upon you, what would your message be to a newly diagnosed person?
So first of all, I would say, you know, work very closely with your neurologist, because that's the person who really understands MS and MS from a medical perspective. But then I would say complement that. Complement that with health behaviors, particularly diet and particularly exercise. And the reason for that is that if people start exercising and they start eating well early on in their disease, they will develop some health habits that can last for the entire course of their disease. Mm-hmm. They can further start to create a reserve capacity, both a physical reserve and a neural reserve and a cognitive reserve, through early intervention that will last them a lifetime. And the last thing I'll say, and people don't really recognize this as much as they should, but one of the things that we've learned a lot from Ruth Ann Marie from Canada is that comorbid conditions, things like hypertension, diabetes, obesity, they make the disease much worse, much faster. And exercise and diet prevent those things from occurring in the first place. And so you can manage comorbid conditions through diet and exercise and totally slow down the rate at which the disease will progress and live with a higher functioning life the rest of your life through those health behaviors. And so that's what I would say. Someone diagnosed today, listen to your neurologist, follow your neurologist's advice, but also pick up an exercise program and try to eat as healthy as you absolutely can.
I guess when you talk about this, and obviously we're not giving medical advice or anything, but just hearing you talk and just with my experiences and everything, you know, when somebody's newly diagnosed, the first thing that we learn or we're told is, you know, look to get on a disease modifying therapy. I guess the question then is, should we also be combining that then with the exercise, with everything? And it's not just this one thing of going out getting the medical help, but I mean, when you're talking exercise, diet and things, what a quick, I don't want to say easy way, but I mean, just something where you don't need a prescription to do it.
Yeah, that's the beauty of exercise and diet. You don't need a prescription. There are lots of resources, but it doesn't have to be very complicated either. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the first things I tell people is just walk out your front door and go for 5 minutes. You don't have to go for 30 minutes on day one. Go for 5 minutes. And tomorrow, walk out your front door and go for 5 minutes. And the next day, walk out your door and go for 5 minutes and do that for a couple of weeks. And then as you get more used to it, try to do 7.5 minutes.
Yeah, just.
And then, yeah, Jennifer, slowly build up to it, right?
Right. And I think this is interesting. You know, I had mentioned that we had been diagnosed for quite some time, and we were talking about newly diagnosed, but even those of us long timers, if you'll give me that, we can benefit from watching our diet and getting more activity. That's what I'm taking from you. Would you agree?
I would agree wholeheartedly. I think, you know, we're starting to generate evidence that exercise has substantial benefits amongst those who are just diagnosed, all the way through people who've been with the disease 30, 40, 50 years. And also we have evidence that exercise, physical activity are beneficial in children who are diagnosed with the disease, as well as older adults who are diagnosed with the disease. That is, people who are diagnosed really late in life. And so, you know, it's really safe to say that anywhere you are in your journey with MS, it's safe to exercise. You know, one of the things that I get asked, well, you know, you mentioned just go out the door and walk. Well, what if I'm in a wheelchair and I can't just go out the door and walk? Mm-hmm. There still are a lot of things that you can do. You know, you can, I was just talking to a gentleman earlier today. He's like, yeah, I just pedal my arms in the air like I'm using an arm bike in front of me. And I do that for a minute or two. And I do that every time I see a commercial on TV, or every time I need a break from working in front of my computer. I just kind of get my arms going around cycling for 2 minutes, and that counts as physical activity. Or, you know, just doing things in a seated position, like doing arm curls with cans of vegetables. You know, it doesn't have to be complicated. You don't have to go to a gym to get these benefits. You can do it right in your home.
And it's interesting because, Rob, I am a wheelchair user, and I am overweight. I am the first to admit that. And it's hard. It's hard to lose weight when you are. And I've talked numerous times on our podcast that it's a never-ending battle, but I'm not going to give up. And Weight Watchers has been my friend, just to kind of give me that structure to work towards losing weight. But how about you? Do you have a diet that you would recommend?
So I'm not really super well versed in diet.
Okay.
But I am in a department of kinesiology and nutrition. So I spend a lot of time with nutritionists and dietitians. And from what I've been told, they believe that the Mediterranean diet or the MIND diet are the best approaches for overall health with a variety of different conditions. And my colleagues mostly study this in individuals who are cancer survivors. But they believe that it also, those diets have great benefits in a variety of other populations, including multiple sclerosis. And the MIND diet is a diet that's supposed to help support cognition and brain health and things along those lines. And so, and you can find information on the MIND diet, the Mediterranean diet on Google. There are recipe books. There's all sorts of resources to find information on those diets and how to put them in place. But that seems to be the best.
Well, thank you. That's important. And I know that along with healthy eating and exercise with multiple sclerosis, and your emotional health is something. And I know that exercise you've shown and what we've read, just what a benefit exercise makes on your well-being, your depression, or just your emotional health. So it just, it sounds so all-encompassing, good for your well-being.
Yeah, you know, Jennifer, you couldn't be more right. I think the power of exercise is its influence across so many different outcomes. And so part of the reason that I really sit well with that is that exercise is really one of the only things that you can do that activates nearly every physiological system in the entire human body. And it does it in a very coordinated way. And so we're talking about exercise stimulating the muscle system, the cardiovascular system, the metabolic systems, but also the central nervous system, i.e. the brain, to coordinate all this. And as a result of all those things being activated, you get these really amazing outcomes, but you also get those outcomes associated with brain health, particularly mood, particularly reductions in anxiety and depression. And those are so powerful. You know, we want people to have those mood enhancing benefits, to feel better about life and to feel better about, you know, their daily existence. And exercise does that in such a powerful, robust way.
Excuse me, as we're talking about the research and everything, I'm thinking back then to when you talked about, you know, the original study that drove you into, you know, the MS research with baclofen and everything. Where did you go from there? I mean, just because you have it and you think of MS as such a huge, wide-ranging disease with so many different symptoms, so many different things, and how it affects people. How do you whittle that down? What's your area of interest where you're just like, this is where I'm going with it?
So, you know, I'm not a person who starts small. Probably one of my biggest strengths and weaknesses at the same time. But when we started to look at the work on exercise and spasticity back in, and this was in 2003, we also started to see that there wasn't much else known about the benefits of exercise and physical activity with MS. There was a study here, a study there, but no one was systematically doing this. And so while we're doing this work on exercise and spasticity, I thought, well, okay, if you want to study exercise and physical activity behavior, the first thing you have to do is be able to measure it. And you need to be able to measure it precisely. Because if you want to have an exposure variable, you need to be able to know how much of that exposure you're giving to people. So we actually started by just seeing if we could precisely measure physical activity and exercise behavior in people with MS. And then as we were doing that, we started to see, okay, well, now that we can measure it, let's study the outcomes of this behavior from cells to society. So we started to examine physical activity in relationship to the structure and function of the brain based on MRI outcomes, based on optical coherence tomography of the nerve cells in the eye, based on electrocortical activity in the brain. Then we started to move into a variety of different outcomes all the way through to people being able to engage in full life occupations, tasks, demands, pursuits. So while we're doing that, then we started to wonder, well, how do we change physical activity behavior? So then we started doing research on variables that could be barriers to being physically active and variables that could facilitate physical activity behavior. And as we pulled all that together, we finally felt like we were ready to start doing these large randomized controlled trials where we would develop these interventions that could change physical activity and sustain that change in physical activity even after the intervention was done. And we could examine the effects on things like fatigue and depression and anxiety, quality of life, cognition, walking, body composition, fitness. You know, you just name the outcome. And we were trying to study the effects of these interventions. And we're still doing that to today. So it really just took off like insanity. And the beauty of it is that I have a full lab of PhD students, of postdocs, of undergraduates who are committed and dedicated to this research. And each one of them kind of comes into this space and we talk about their desires, their passions, their interests, and we find a research project for them to lead and do. And by having myself and 20 other people around me doing research, you can only imagine how productive we can be.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I'm sure people listening to this are excited. I know that I am, and thinking, not selfishly, but somewhat selfishly, how do I get involved, or how do listeners get involved, or is that something where people can get involved in your research, or
Jennifer, thank you for asking that. We're always looking for people to get involved in our research, but we're also happy to just talk to people about our research and help them figure out how to put exercise in place for them. So there are two ways to kind of most readily get in touch with us. One is you can email our lab, and that email is enrl@uic.edu. Or people can just email me directly. My email is robmotl@uic.edu. Either one of those, we'll get back to you usually same day. And then we'll schedule a call and chat with you. And if you want to do research, we'll find a project for you. If you just want to know what we're up to, we'll tell you all about it. If you want some advice on how to integrate exercise, physical activity into your life, we'll talk about that too. We're a full service shop. We're here to help every person with MS any way we can.
Nice.
And was it just serendipitous that MS, I mean, you're offering these incredible, incredible gifts to the MS population. Did you know of MS, or did you have a connection before you started?
Jennifer, I get that question all the time, and you're not going to necessarily like the answer. The answer is I don't have any family connection to MS. Until I started doing MS research, I didn't know anybody personally mm-hmm. who had multiple sclerosis. A lot of it was serendipity, but I will tell you this. This serendipity has given more meaning to my life and my career and my academic pursuits than I could have ever imagined and hoped for. And it's one of those things of, on an ongoing basis, I get to talk to someone who's been involved in my research and hear about life-changing things that have occurred through exercise. So, for example, we've been doing this study called TEAMS, which is Targeted Exercise for African Americans with Multiple Sclerosis, and it's funded by the Bristol-Myers Squibb Foundation. And some of the participants in this study have told us things like, you know, I gave up doing the things that I love doing around the house because I just had detrained so much. I had lost my capacity to kind of do the tasks that I really like to do, the fun things, and I'm doing them again. So we had one participant say, you know, I used to have this beautiful flower garden in the front of my house. And, you know, when my MS got worse and I kind of gave up, it just fell apart. And she said halfway through the study, she started gardening again and was sending us pictures of her garden.
Oh, wow.
And how beautiful it was. And to me, like, it's not the publications, it's not the grants, it's not going and giving a talk. It's about hearing these stories about how you can change someone's life through exercise that is really all you need to sustain your career and your passion on a daily basis, in my opinion.
And that is so powerful. And you say that I'm not going to like that answer, but about you not having MS in your family or your life before you started this, but that's so meaningful that you just landed on multiple sclerosis and you've made so many improvements and helped so many people. So I think that's beautiful. So thank you for sharing that. What
Yeah, my pleasure.
So then looking at everything you've done and, you know, the connections you've made with, you know, people in research and stuff, looking back, what surprised you the most about MS research and with exercise and multiple sclerosis?
So I sort of alluded to this earlier. One of the most surprising things is just the simple power of exercise across all outcomes for all people with multiple sclerosis. It just seems like exercise really can be considered medicine in multiple sclerosis for every person with MS, regardless of how they exercise. Exercise is powerful. The other thing that I've learned from people with MS through this research is that people with MS are the most unselfish people in the world. They will give so much in hopes that the research you're doing can help someone else who's living with this disease and ultimately live a better life with multiple sclerosis. And to me, like, I never expected that going into this, Dan and Jennifer. I would have never expected that. And that generosity has just blown me away.
Wow.
That's that MS community. None of us wanted the disease, but now that we have it, we want to turn it into something good and or use it to good. So that's really nice.
You know, when I mentioned earlier, just like when we were diagnosed and they kind of told people to shy away from it. And then once you really started getting into it, you're saying how there wasn't a lot of research out there about it. Do you feel, I don't want to say an uphill battle, but I mean, did it take early on like some convincing that it's like, no, this exercise is real? And that people need to do this. And if so, do you feel like you are a groundbreaker in this, but I mean, you were at the leading edge of this. And do you still get pushback from any of the old timers that say this isn't good?
Yeah. So when we were first starting, I went to a lot of different conferences and one of my traits is I'll talk to anybody anytime, whenever. my wife always says, There's a new best friend in every crowd that I go to. And I just started talking to these leaders, these neurologists who were these world-renowned individuals in the field of multiple sclerosis, and just started having conversations with them and asking them what they thought about exercise, what they thought were important questions to ask, how to go about doing it, what sort of concerns. And what I found is that these neurologists were so excited by someone who is willing to focus on physical activity and MS and make that an exclusive research area of interest. And the neurologists, by and large, were very supportive, very encouraging. They would write letters of recommendation for grants that I was writing.
Nice.
They would help co-author papers that I was working on where I needed the insights and expertise that comes from neurologists who are so passionately trained about multiple sclerosis. And it really wasn't much of an uphill battle at all. The uphill battle was that there wasn't a lot of research funding at the time, very early on. Mm-hmm. But that changed very quickly. The National Institutes of Health, the DOD, the National MS Society, and many other organizations like the Consortium of MS Centers, for example, they started to put more and more money towards exercise, physical activity research in neurological diseases, particularly multiple sclerosis. And that really accelerated things. The third accelerant was that I had amazing undergraduate, graduate, and postdoctoral trainees around me. And they wanted to learn about physical activity and exercise in the context of MS. And they would bring in their passion, they would bring in their interest, their enthusiasm, and they would do their advanced degrees completely in the context of physical activity and multiple sclerosis. And as they graduated and become professors at other institutions, they're now leading research on their own. They're training another generation of individuals who are going to become the next leaders. And so really, it's been so many amazing people who see the value and the passion for this research, who have just supported it. And, you know, I wouldn't consider myself a leader. I'd consider myself someone who's been on a surfboard riding the waves the whole way along.
That's, you know, ride the waves. And where are the waves taking you next?
Yeah, that's so there are a couple of things that are on my list of very ambitious projects. So I've been arguing for quite a while that exercise is a disease-modifying behavior, not a disease-modifying drug or therapy, but a disease-modifying behavior. And so what I mean by that is I think that exercise with medications and other clinical procedures can be an added layer in managing multiple sclerosis and slowing down the rate of disease progression. So we're orienting a lot of our research grants that we're writing right now towards exercise and disease modification. The second thing that we're doing is that we're moving towards the dissemination and implementation science space. So we have great information on what people should do. Okay, so we have exercise guidelines, we have prescriptions. We're still building more information around those and refining them, but we know what people should do. We have neurologists who are often telling patients that they should engage in exercise. Now we need to know how to get exercise more broadly into the hands of people with MS, and that's the dissemination and implementation science space that we're working in. We need to do more work, and we're doing more work on exercise in underserved populations with multiple sclerosis. Mm-hmm. So we used to think of MS as a disease that primarily affected individuals who are white or Caucasian, but now we know that MS occurs at a high rate in individuals who are Black or the Hispanic population, but there's virtually no research on exercise and rehab in those populations. And so we've been building a big research enterprise to do exercise in underserved populations. And I'll give you two other areas where we're going. One is we know now that there are more people 55 years of age and older with MS than any other age group of the adult lifespan. And that number is only going to continue to grow over the next 25 years as we have more older adults in this country. Wow. And right now, we don't know anything about how to manage the disease in these individuals. There's not a lot known. A lot of scientists are doing a lot of work in this area, and we've been developing exercise programs for older adults with MS to maintain walking function, cognitive function, through improvements in brain health. And then the last thing that we're interested in, this really surprised my lab the other day, because I'm this traditional exercise. We got to do aerobic exercise. We need to do a resistance exercise. And I told them, you guys, I want to start doing research on mind-body exercise training. And what I mean by that is things like yoga and Pilates, where you are very much having to use your mind-muscle connection to control your body in a very meaningful way. And there's this constant feedback between the brain and the periphery. And I think that stimulus is going to change around the brain and ultimately the disease processes in a way like no other form of exercise can.
Wow.
So that's what's on my horizon for the next 10 years.
And that's Dan and I are sitting here as we're both in our early 50s, and we're thinking, wow, we're just going to have to, again, using the wave, we're going to have to ride the wave with you, because this is so promising. And it's nice to hear, again, being in our 50s, to know that we're not going to be ignored, that you and your research and your that is going to age with us and continue wanting to think about us. Not that you aren't focusing on the newly diagnosed, but we're not being put out to pasture.
So, no way. No. I'm on the wave with you, because I'm in my middle 50s too.
Okay.
I'm learning every day. I need to make sure that I'm getting in some movement, some exercise, mm-hmm. watching my diet. You know, it's important for all of us. But the message is that we're giving is you can age well with multiple sclerosis. You really can age well with MS if you do the right things.
That is such a powerful message, especially to someone who is newly diagnosed, thinking, oh no, what about my future? Or to someone like Dan and me that have been living with the disease for 25 years. We can age well with MS. And I think that is, thank you so much for sharing that with us.
My pleasure.
And I think then, you know, looking at everything else, and for the listeners out there, we will have links to all of this for more information about Rob and his research and how you can contact him. Was there anything else as far as like the work you do? Because, I mean, you have so much. Anything that we didn't talk about that the world needs to know?
Boy, I think we covered the entire landscape of what I've done for 25 years.
very high level, right?
I was going to say high level because you've done so much.
Well, and it's important to recognize the we and all that, because like I've mentioned, none of this was possible without amazing mentors, financial support from the federal government organizations, from undergraduates, graduates, postdocs, collaborators. You know, it really has taken an army to get where we are. And the good thing is that army is only expanding, and we can take it way further.
I love that. So good. Well, Rob, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us for this episode of A Couple Takes on MS. And again, everyone, there will be links in the liner notes, show notes for this to learn more about the work he's doing and how you can get involved. And so, Rob, again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Dan and Jennifer. I really appreciated being here and having this really fun conversation.
It was good.
Thank you. It was very nice.
Thank you for being so encouraging. And so until next time, we are A Couple Takes on MS. I'm Dan Digman, and I'm walking.
And I'm Jennifer Digman, who's rolling.
And we are A Couple Takes on MS. And together, we're moving forward. We hope you enjoyed this episode of A Couple Takes on MS. Be sure to subscribe, rate us, and share your review to let us know how we're doing and what you want us to talk about in future episodes. You can email us at acoupletakesonms@gmail.com or follow us on our blog, coupletakesonms.com, or on Twitter at coupletakesonms. Until next time, take care and keep moving forward.